Thank you very much. I'd have to change that biographical note. It sounds horrendously boring. Thanks especially to Paul for inviting me. I don't worry. Oh, there he is. Thank you very much for inviting me. Thank you all for coming. It's great to be down in Cork again. I'm going to read just a few poems from four different books. I was only going to read from three books, but Eamon Linsky is somewhere. He's disappeared. Where's he gone? Oh, there he is. Eamon Linsky has asked a special request, and since he came up from Dublin all the way to hear me, I'm going to read two poems from Femispheres, especially dedicated to Eamon. One is poem that you will all identify with in some way. It's called The Blank Page. Sorry, I'm just going to take off my watch to keep a check on the time. The Blank Page. It's no use writing on a blank page. There's no such thing. Emptiness is always a confused moment, midway between the need to erupt and the need to be filled. Words and acts relentlessly looking back, looking forward, urging poems in our veins to make them pulsate on the page, like new lovers in the ripe moments before sleep. And the other poem requested by Eamon, if anybody has any other requests, please feel free. I'm quite happy to read requests. This one is called Quechua. Quechua is, as you probably know, one of the languages of Peru. And I went there probably in 2005, I think it was, and had an interesting experience. We were up very high up in the Andes trekking. Quechua. If you listen, you hear the wind blowing you down. You hear the Milky Way spunking along the sky, and the night takes a deep breath, as if about to explain the exact reason it's so close to the black hole at the center of love, but refuses to get sucked in. You hear the origin of thought pick a path through the unwritten word in heaps of dung penned in by stone walls, where a universe of hens and hogs daintily dance around each other at some angle other than the orbit of logic. And you know you've heard the truth. You hear silence, the desolation of altitude with its eloquent patterns etched to extreme locution, running with its tongue ablaze in the glaciers, whispering as they melt. And that I read some poems from this book. I have to explain this. It was written with Nina Karakosta, who is a Greek poet who writes in English. And we decided to do a collaborative project. And the idea was I would give her a word in Irish, which she doesn't speak, so she didn't know what the word meant. I didn't tell her the meaning. And she would give me a word in Greek, and I didn't know the meaning of the word in Greek. And we just had to write the poem based on the sound of the word. So I wrote poems which all have titles in Greek, and her poems all have titles in Irish. And we didn't tell each other what the words meant until the end of the entire project. So we had no idea, you know, how we were responding to these words. So, let's see. Yep. I have to hope that I'm pronouncing these correctly in Greek. So the word she gave me was ischios. I think that's how you pronounce it.
Ischios.
Ischios. Do you know what it means?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool. Well, I didn't know what it meant. I'll tell you at the end what it means. This is the poem that I wrote just based on the sound of ischios. The island calls in shades you mentioned yesterday. Easy blue, slow red, obsidian, pure spectacle. There are flowers whose names want to enter me, silences that keep cascading, a little here, a little drops of dew, hibiscus playing on elements of meaningless, sand saying nothing, and why should it? Why shed more than a few millennia's worth, grind more, corrode? Coral is luminous, and it just is. Get that. If you've never seen it, try getting away from it. Swim against a current till the palms on the shoreline wave, their goodbyes start sinking with you, to a point where your skin bubbles and bursts from too much salt, your eye flakes feed the fish. If you survive, you'll know what luminous is. Ischios to me sounded like the name of a Greek island, basically, which is why I wrote this. The actual meaning of it is shade or shadow.
In Spanish, Ischios is the back part of the leg.
It's a
mascot.
Okay. Much less poetic.
Is that
just as well, I wasn't doing it in Spanish then. Okay. And the next word is amerolipsia. Amerolipsia. And I have no idea why I wrote this poem, why it suggested this to me, other than the fact that when I was writing these poems with Nina, we wrote some of them. We worked together one summer in Spain and one summer in Ireland. And we were in Spain and we went to Malaga to the Picasso Museum. So somehow Amerolipsia crept into Picasso. Today we visited the Picasso Museum, where everyone was in love except Picasso. He frowned and said he was trying to live in the moment with its intensity and wasn't searching for anything, not some future form or aspiration. Sometimes the less sure you are, the more convincing you come across. I wanted to take note, liberate myself from want, but his brow creased to lowercase xi, unintelligible, and Olga gave him such a bitter look, I could tell he had lied. Obsession is not of the moment, it's of the past, a refusal of anything but mother's milk, the sea slapping under her armpits, and jasmine round her waist, releasing witchcraft. In the museum, Dora tried to distract him, flaunting her thighs, piece of pie, squatted at his request over his mouth, dancing all the way down to his cock, right breast swinging left, maracuya, left breast ripening round the back of a chair, olé! For a moment, he forgot what had driven him to anger. All those gypsy words that lost their lips in his youth, bulls and guitars blinding the walls with regret. I actually liked Picasso until I went to the museum. I don't like him anymore. He wasn't very nice to women, and it really comes across in that museum. And then I read a few poems from this collection, which was published about a year and a half ago, Onwards and Upwards. And some of you may have been to Anna McCarrick, the writer's residence. It's a very special kind of a place for all kinds of reasons, but it was a place where I had the chance that I don't often have to just, take things really slowly and engage with the landscape that was around. It's a very peaceful sort of a place. I'm not sure whether it was poetic or just madness, but things started to kind of speak to me while I was there. I dedicated it to two women who were there when I was there. Memory for Sasha Abercorn and Kate Muldoon. Deep within these stones, memory runs amok in its attempt to speak and flow. Its accent changes with our comings and goings, ebbing through the earth, stumbling on the occasional lump in its throat, the odd Scots or Gaelic diphthong of a pebble colliding with a blade of grass. We hear it gasp and stutter in our sleep, though we cannot understand a word, rooted as we are in the fixity of things. The urge to be heard sweeps the landscape softly, like a flurry lost the moment it hits the ground. And this is all we have by way of recollection, this air and space, lithographic wisdom, now no more than whispers through the water lines. And the next poem I'll read is very frivolous. My kids were starting to play the piano many years ago, and we have an old piano at home, and I thought I better get a tuner in to tune the piano. So this guy arrived. He didn't have a tuning fork or any kind of instrument that you might expect a tuner to have. He obviously had perfect pitch. And he was missing a finger, and he just started playing the piano, absolutely gorgeous stuff. And yeah, but as he was playing, then he'd stop and he'd say, "Oh, it's terribly out of tune," or it shifted a semitone or something. And I mean, you wouldn't be able to hear this unless you had perfect pitch, obviously. But I just thought it would be lovely to have this guy at home every day playing the piano. So I wrote this poem, and I can't remember why I called it Sleepless, but anyway, it obviously kept me awake at night. I have the piano tuner for his fingers, even the one that's half missing, in action stripping his skin to jazzed up water wind. Thursday I'll have his face, Friday his telltale hair, the strand that lops over his eye, canicular, like summer when the room stings with his reserve, pitching what he hears in drum and hammer, coquillage so pearled and pure. I want him to come back next week, unlock the spleen in a semitone, petite fleur swimming from one end of his memory to my hippocampus, fudged and back, leaving a wake of structure in the keys, the spine of residual stars. On my deathbed too, I want him tuning the tunnels from here to all the phantoms. No fanfare, just pianissimo. Though agitato's okay, if that's what he wants. We won't be such strangers by then. And this next poem, I was very fortunate. A friend of mine went to Taipei. I don't know what he was doing, working out there in the university, and I went out to visit. It happened to be Poetry Week out there. actually, I think this is just a digression. They didn't understand the concept of the open mic in Taipei. It's not done. It's all a very formal kind of a thing. So I think I initiated the first open mic in Taipei. It's just spontaneously in a pub one evening. Somebody liked the idea so much, he said, "Why don't we do an open mic?" I said, "Yeah, great idea." So anyway, but the thing about Taipei was the colour of the city at night. I couldn't describe it. And a lot of my poetry is about things that I obviously can't express very well in words, so I end up using a ton of words to try and get to the nub of it somehow. So it's called Taipei, and it's all about trying to capture the particular colour. Taipei. I wake, my arms wrapped around the city, legs enjambed with its towers, skyward, a formal composition, silence, stylized, flowers through its lights, the smallness of them, struck by shadowed stills, the colour of cavities, of not wanting to disturb, harmony, respect. 28 degrees at midnight, slums unshimmering slumber. The eye insists on definition, colour resists, chaos versus order. Could hang me. It's a hollow that isn't black, but marinated, stinky tofu, where the street light sizzles. Maybe it's a smell, a size, the meaning of a name I can never forget. Beautiful soup. Corrugated iron angles into place. Discreet, elegant. Blanket blue and rust roof red staggered across some great want where the revolution daubs its palette of scars. Some of those words, like beautiful soup, are actually the names of people that I met while I was over there. I met quite a few poets, and their names in Chinese all have meanings. So somebody's name was Beautiful Soup, which I thought was a rather odd thing to call your daughter. Anyway, this one is a found poem. I don't write too many found poems, but it's good fun to do. And I literally took the Irish Times, and on each page I just selected phrases and put them all together. I didn't really mess around with it, put too much of my own input into it. And the funny thing was, I wrote it quite a few years ago during the crisis, and to be honest, it still applies, and I suspect it will for a long time. Lines from the Irish Times. I hate saying it, but we are where we are. Devastated, numb day. Concerning the obvious inflation, above the 3% limit and underneath every single one of those rooftops is a horror story. Trials, indifference to trials. The two fingers. Some absolutely love it, immune from the application of the law. It is unjust. The warnings are of danger, loss of biodiversity. Perhaps more surprising is the presence of fight-like apes, popular obsessions with the weather, potholes, fantastic electrofolk stylings. A real shame that the solar bears haven't been recognised. Fun, amuse, inform. Keystones to pedagogy. You might like to demonstrate to children some of the properties of water, though you've difficulty making an emotional connection. Stressed for 3 solid years and need to stop. What makes someone a kind, warm person tapping into and beyond our greatest hopes? Amazing, the doctor said all this about her. But, there is outrage at a man and a woman who appear to be on the verge of a kiss. Paranoia. If you're not with us, you're against us. I order the defendant to be held to answer. He sounded nervous. Hedda Gabler, vulgar and hedonistic. Outside the courthouse, we could draw strength from one another, appear pleased at the outcome, appear randy, bridling at the suggestion that we are less than forthcoming. But there is deep anger and a feeling of helplessness, fear of the future, fudge at the fissures and a profound sense of betrayal. There is, to a worrying degree, disillusionment, inconvenience caused to householders and the business community. But having a hissy fit about a hoe is a peculiarly dispiriting, undignified experience, giving rise to damages for post-traumatic stress disorder, depressive disorder, nervous shock, nightmares. And this one I wrote back in 2011. There was an amazing act brought in. I don't know if you remember. I have it here in the poem. It was Section 2 of the Criminal Offences Public Order Act of 2011. It was an act that makes begging in the streets illegal, which I thought was a horrendous comment on where society is going. So I wrote this poem called Bewildering. It also got me thinking, obviously, about, you know, nanny state and the government just controlling absolutely everything you do. Feet footworking the concrete on their busy, busy way through streets, legging it A to B under CCTV, under the clock, around the bus, the tram, the man who's sitting half-bridged across the river of piss, home with his cardboard box and his sign quietly colouring your trajectory as he sinks into asphalt. Beggars, belief. But forget compassion. You don't have time, and it's unsavoury under Section 2 of the Criminal Offences Public Order Act 2011. Acts of kindness or generosity must not be encouraged, must not be seen. They foment disorder, social dyspepsia. Unlike potholes, backhanders, TV screens, harassing you at every supermarket checkout, the law is hissing seductively in your pocket, curled round your hand, steering you through the city like a good committee to protect you from the gutter. The guts of puked proposals, quangos, soiled reports. It might all be too real, too toxic for your delicate entrails. It might cause a random thought to break and enter into your head, rewire a moment of consciousness, a conscience that could lay the roots of revolt, separate you from the health and safety of the herd. And this one I wrote, I think maybe 6 years ago, when the troubles in Syria started. It was supposed to be the Arab Spring, and then I noticed it kind of became the Arab Summer and the Arab Autumn and the Arab Winter. And it's still ongoing. So towards the beginning of that, I read something in the paper about a 13-year-old boy in Syria. His name wasn't given. I've called him Manhal, which is the title of the poem. He was at a protest or something and was taken and tortured, and then his body was dumped in his parents' home at their front gate, basically. And I'm very aware that I kind of struggle with this because you want to do something and it's so hard to do anything. And, you know, I write a poem because I feel the need to respond, but I'm really aware that it's such a pathetic, kind of a useless exercise in a way. But here it is, Manhal. Here is Manhal, not his real name. His real name is mangled under the rubber of a boot at his jaw. His fingers, less righteous than yours, dripping blood, unable to point. His ears split, electrodes pinned to the quiet parts of his protest, till he hears his skin through the surge, singeing the seconds, then minutes, a scream which may not even be his. Another day is kicked out of his mouth. Relentless, it burns to ash in the dark with butts that have been branded, that have branded his feet. Lacerates its way to print in a world that is a lifetime away. Manhal, aged 13, paying for belief, things you cannot touch or see. Time blurs, smouldering in his head, time that has come too soon, too late. Spring in disguise, summer in revolt, and death, death in strobes. Physical, as the boy standing in the street last week, speaking a tongue now tied to despair, now swelling with the crowd, its news contused, outraged. I don't write too many happy poems, so apologies. Oh, here's another very depressing poem. It's called Jezebel. Jezebel, you may know from the Bible, she was a much maligned woman. I think she was misunderstood, as many women are. She came to her husband's country, he was the king, I can't even remember what country it was, but because she was foreign, she was misunderstood. She brought her own God with her, well, she prayed to her God, and that wasn't looked on terribly kindly. So I wrote this in two voices, so to speak. I hope it comes through. One of the voices is Jezebel herself, trying to see things from the point of view of her husband and his family, who eventually killed her. No, I can't say anything about that. Wither my fingers as the hazel branch, burn my eyes, be I smitten, be I hurled by his brothers and his sisters from my window to my death. I can't say the marriage fell apart round about the time I stopped doing his ironing, round about the time I stopped, round about the time for breaking bread, when fear black blossomed and his mother's spittle and his sister's spite soured on my face. Fustigate me, desert winds, be I accursed, bludgeoned, poxed. I can't say that I fell for the wrong person, made the wrong choice. Falling is predestined. I have only myself to blame that he lacked vision to see my loyalty. I can't say falling hurts. Struck be I, incinerated, and my tongue timely plucked by demons. Falling for the wrong person is allowed only sometimes when falling works to his advantage. When his advantage is to hold all the cards, he, the king. Although, miserable I, castigate and chasten me. It probably requires some ironing too. And sex, the deep abyss of silence that surrounds the sex of the abused. I can't say the circumstances. My ears be hacked, thwart my thoughts. But sex is a good bargaining chip. Tell that to your daughters at least. I can't say anything about sex because it's unsavory, he says, and if he says so, then balsam for his ears. There's a tussle over that. Tussle, a euphemism for battery that goes unreported. I can't say that either. Baal, I beseech you. I can't say that I worked hard to build our home, that I toiled to bear our children, that all my labours were for them. I can't say that I sacrificed myself because the woman who works too hard concerns herself with the material. Is Jezebel far from home, scorned, maligned? The material must only be a man who stitches a woman's lips, holds the privilege of provision. Working too hard is only allowed when working too hard works out. There are questions surrounding this that I must not ask. Not now, not then. Patience, then chastity, temperance, charity, diligence, kindness, humility. I have been a virtuous wife. Smite me, vented be their wrath, wind whipped on my skin. I can't say I sold myself short, because I sold nothing. All I had were the cheerful mornings of my youth, a fickle fate, and trust, which I freely gave, as if all adventures in trust were for the taking, to be pillaged. Hack my limbs, a plague descend on me. I am dust under his feet and the feet of my sons. Cast me to the ground, my flesh be ripped by dogs. I can say none of this, because there is no evidence. They will think me mad. It is only what I know in my heart. It is my life, every minute and every hour of the life I built on sand. So I read a few from the very latest publication, which is called Crunch. It's published by Taurus Press, a very fairly new independent publisher set up by Elizabeth Skeen in Dublin. It's actually my first Irish publication, so I was very happy about that. It is the entire book, it's the only book that I've ever written with a kind of a cohesive theme going through it. It's a book in the voice of the apple in the Garden of Eden. The apple observing Eve as she's thinking of taking the apple and so on. So it's kind of a comment on what we think about women, what we think about transgression and so on. I'll start with a sort of a prayer. Skin peel, blitz blend, whole heel, as it was, fervent, shall be. Sugar starch, sun sweet, whole high, as it were, ferment, now then. I won't read this one, but it's my one and only concrete poem, so which was, they managed to do it with the colours, which is very nice. But anyway, I'll read this one. I was neither Eve nor Adam in the Garden of Eden, nor the arguments between them over who and why. I was the apple, bitten, tossed aside, her teeth marks still on my flesh, her fingertips warm on my skin. Go on, bite me. It's already been done. I'm crunchy, sweet, ripe, and ready for retribution. I know what it's like to be the apple of her eye, night and day her foremost thought, the drive to turn complacency on its head. I know what it's like to see the plot unfolding in the shape of her hand, reaching out to me, such intensity of purpose overriding fear. Her impulse to bite is a test, not of virtue, but intelligence. When she looks at me, she can tell there is more worth knowing than the pampering that goes on in paradise. She can tell I am the key to the secrets of the universe. It is why I am so edible to her discerning eye as she examines me now in the palm of her hand. She lifts me to her face, but it will still take a leap of faith for her to bite. And the next poem, is a response to Van Eyck's Adoration of the Mystic Lamb. It's a painting, it's in several panels. And in one of the panels, Eve is there. She's obviously just bitten the apple. And what struck me about the painting was that having committed this absolute atrocity, biting the apple and bringing about the downfall of all of humanity forever, she just looks a little bit bored. She doesn't look one bit shocked or aghast or anything. So I have the apple choreographing Eve for the artist to paint her in this particular pose. Here, like this. Fingers barely touching the ridges of my skin. These tactile rugae that hold oils and hints of light. Glints of ivory falsehoods. How can this be you or me? Fingers tilting me to obscurity. Yes, a little further from view. To the darkness of a gaze that believes none of it. The darkness of an ignorance that believes it all. Fingers light. There must be no sensuality in this. You couldn't get your nipples to look less naughty, could you? Fingers lingering, almost as if untouching me. Fingers on a hand detached from body, though looming from your womb, echoing your ripeness, in such a way that the eye falls on many myths, mistruths, salacious hues. Fingers slightly parted, though not immediately obvious as two fingers, while simultaneously suggesting, come hither. Can you do that? It's essential to the story. Never mind. Fingers on the other hand now. Limp, a slaughtered lamb. Draining from the body. Framing your distended belly without intent. This new modesty reeking of boredom. Fingers far from me, crawling into the nethers of the garden. You and me, equal and opposite temptations in this endless telling. That's good. Fingers self-sufficient, despite being relegated to the edge of the world, performing all the body's needs, an innocence too threatening.
Yes. A couple of short ones.
Perfect. A short one. I will go mad. Malic grief undoing the simplest joys. Eternity undoing itself on her tongue. So, and I'll finish with a very short one. After she's bitten the apple and she's gone running off wondering what next. What now? My raison d'etre shrivels, perhaps to be a slice of art. A muse, victim of a hunger. Nuance that passes for truth. What is the garden now? Its juices exposed, delighting in chaos? A first fractal, no doubt. All animal, all earth. Thank you very much.